It's now been a month since the start of the standoff on the mountain. Protesters on Mount Achaia took up positions in the middle of July when construction crews were expected to begin work on the planned 30-meter telescope. In the weeks since then, there's been a lot of activity on the mountain, the vast majority of it organized by those opposed to the telescope. That's gotten a lot of attention, but we've heard less from the scientific community. At HBR, we're committed to continue to hear voices on all sides of this issue, and today we're hearing from three guests from the Mauna Kea Observatories. Dr. Doug Simons is the Executive Director of the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope. Dr. Jessica Dempsey is the Deputy Director of the East Asian Observatory and the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope. And Rich Matsuda is the Chief of Operations at the W.M. Keck Observatory, with an extensive background in electronics and design engineering. We spoke late yesterday afternoon, and this is our discussion in its entirety. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for coming in. And Doug, if I can begin with you, it seems like, especially at the start of the demonstrations, TMT supporters were quieter than opponents, and now that seems to be changing a bit. There are television ads running, a bit more of a PR campaign. Why do you think the slow start for voices in support of this project?
Yeah, I think there are some distinctions to keep in mind. TMT's always had a significant presence, and they've obviously sort of ramped it up more recently, given the state of the protests now. The observatories have tried to establish themselves as well, the Mauna Kea observatories, and having a voice and making sure our perspectives are heard as well. And we really tried to ramp it up when it was clear to us early in the protests that the road was going to be blocked and we needed to regain access to put our people back to work. So in response to that, you heard more and more from the observatories to make sure that our concerns were heard by the community, recognizing that it's probably going to be the community that helps us all get back to work and sort of normalize things again for the observatories in the future.
And Jessica, you're responsible for the day-to-day operations of the telescopes. How has that changed for you, I guess, since the beginning of the direct action on the mountain, and now technicians are being able to get up there? Are you satisfied with the amount of access that they're getting? How's that going?
So 4 weeks off the sky was the longest the Mauna Kea observatories have ever been without observing in the 50-year history of astronomy in Mauna Kea. And it was very hard for the staff. You know, they're very passionate about their jobs. They love what they do. And so that, you know, to start to get back to a semblance of normal operations, which is what we're working towards now, really, of course, they're thrilled to be able to do that. But we're having to step forward slowly because we had to take a lot of instruments essentially out of working because we have to keep them safe. We couldn't get up there easily. So they actually got put into sort of safe modes. It takes a long time sometimes to get them back to operation. So while we are starting to get back on sky, some of our instrumentation may take up to a month to get back operating. Normal daily operations of 50 to 75 people on a day, then contractors and other things like that. So we're ramping up slowly because the access arrangements that we have right now, we are concerned still about safety, and we really want to be cautious. We are just worried about the safety of everyone on the Mauna.
And meanwhile, that demand side for you has picked up in recent years, as I understand. And what has that done to scheduling?
The demand for...
For use of the
Oh, yeah. We're the most in-demand set of telescopes in the world. Five times more time is requested than what we have available. And so to take us off the sky for this length, we had 2,000 hours of missed observing, about a year and a half worth of discoveries. That we will never know what we've missed. And so those things are always on our minds. But the decision to come off the mountain when we did was just one, because we didn't know if we could get someone down off the mountain safe if they were injured or suffering altitude sickness, if the road was blocked. And then we remained off because access was through unsafe areas where there were children in the road. There was a lot of people there, and it wasn't because we were having bad interactions with anybody. They've actually been really pleasant. It's been the fact that it's very congested. There's people and cars. When you go and add fog, nighttime attempts to summit, we just realized the dangers for everybody involved were too high.
And is that situation okay now?
We've had some assurances from the state mm-hmm. and county that they're going to work towards getting us access on the main road, and also DOT, Department of Transport, has put some cinder down on the side road and some cones that make it, some of our safety concerns have been allayed because of that. But for longer term and our regular operations, these concerns still definitely remain, because those risks will just get greater the longer we have to go on like this.
And Rich, you're responsible for the overall operation of Keck's telescopes and also leading community engagement on all this. You're from here. You're a Punahou guy. How's the community outreach part of this changed for you over this experience?
Well, let me just give you a perspective on how our observatory staff members feel. So observatory workers have been a part of the community for the last 5 decades, like Jess has said. And so many of us have friends, family, on all sides of the issue. And so it's been really difficult for the workers to see the level of divide happening in the community, the polarization. And so it's added quite a bit of stress to the workers. Despite this, we try to keep our outreach activities going with the community. So you mentioned outreach. We have public talks that we give to share astronomy. There are school groups that are invited in to the observatories. There's a lot of work to connect community to the observatories. I'll mention a couple of great projects going on. One is the Mauna Kea Scholars Program, which gives public high school students opportunities to use the telescopes. Now, the shutdown has impacted that temporarily, but we have all intentions to continue that program. Another great program that connects telescopes to community, and especially the Hawaiian community in this case, is a program called Ahua He Inoa that gives Hawaiian names to celestial objects, celestial discoveries. And we're really excited about that.
You talk about the cultural aspects of this, and at one point when we get past where we are now and however this turns out, the idea of healing Ho'oponopono as a role within that. How do you see that potentially playing out? Or?
I guess the way I see it is right now, because there's so much emotion around the issue, that our community has become very polarized. But as I said, we have been very embedded and part of the community for a long time. And so really, to me, it starts on the individual relationship level. And all of us who have who work at the observatories have developed many relationships in the community, and we rely on those face-to-face, person-to-person relationships to find common ground, despite whether you agree or not about TMT or you agree about the level of astronomy on Mauna Kea. There's our families grow up together. We all go to shop in the same grocery stores and line up at the same gas stations, and at that human level, we have much in common. And to me, that's where it starts. And maintaining those relationships, having a chance to talk about issues in a safe space, one-on-one, is really where it begins.
Has that conversation been inhibited in terms of the idea of being able to talk honestly?
I think the biggest place it's been inhibited is on social media. I feel that one-on-one over a cup of coffee or a bowl of Simon, that you can have honest conversation with people you trust. On social media, people kind of can leave their check their identity at the door and their responsibility. And sometimes on all sides of the issue, people can be somewhat irresponsible at times. And I think we really, as a community, need to rely on aloha for one another to tamp that down and really have the honest conversations. We don't all have to agree, but we do need to be together in society, working together to try and understand each other's perspectives if we want to find a way forward that we can all live with.
And Doug, you've been doing this a long time here within that context of community. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you're right. I've been 33 years now with Hawaii Astronomy, and it's my life's work in a sense. And my vision very much is that the relationship between the community and the Mauna Kea observatories be so intertwined that they're inseparable over time. And we're doing that through the programs that we have in place now. I'm actually very upbeat, regardless of what happens with the whole TMT protest situation, given the strong support we've witnessed in the recent weeks through the observatories that helped us get back to work, that same support will help propel all of us forward to be in a better place at the end of wherever this protest movement takes us to be. So, as Rich said, it's, you know, we're as much part of the community as anybody, right? And we tend to place that as amongst the highest priorities of anything that we do, that the observatories are an integrated part of the future of Hawaii Island and, in fact, the whole state. And that's done by the relationship building that that we all have to take a personal responsibility for to establish that kind of future that we can all be proud of.
And Jessica, in terms of looking at the science of this, of the observatories that exist and the TMT, to those who say, well, there are so many telescopes up on the mountain already, and what's the harm if there is no TMT?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think when we look at this, the telescopes that are up there, and people say, well, you don't need all of these, surely. And what's remarkable is that each and every one of the telescopes up there fit a unique niche in how they look at the universe. And they collect different wavelengths of light. The universe looks different in those different colors, the ones we can't see. And they're all catching a tiny piece of the puzzle of how our universe works. And it's only by putting those puzzle pieces together with the collection of those telescopes that you really start to understand the truth of what's going on. TMT will add yet another facet to that truth. The bigger dish, it allows you to see tinier details, it allows you to be more sensitive. It is a complementary science to what is done up there at the other telescopes, but it doesn't replace the science that has been done at the other telescopes. Every time a new instrument, a new camera is designed for one of our telescopes, it suddenly becomes a new experiment. And so each of these are revitalized, and this is something which I think people think, oh, well, this is a really old telescope. It was built in the late 70s. CFHT is the second most productive telescope in the world, and yet it's one of the oldest up there. It's as good as your instruments. That's how you do science. And so TMT will complement what is already up there, but it doesn't immediately mean that anything up there and what they're doing is obsolete.
And the idea of location, of is there anywhere other than the summit itself that this can go?
You mean TMT specifically?
Yeah. Yes.
That's a general statement about the unique properties of Mauna Kea, which all the observatories are able to take good advantage of. And the simplest explanation for why Mauna Kea is mostly in the form of its topography. As a shield volcano with gentle slopes, it doesn't introduce what we call turbulence in the atmosphere as the trade winds blow up and over the surface of this gigantic shield volcano. And if you think about it, it's a completely unique geophysical structure on the planet because it's surrounded by thousands of miles of a flat surface called Pacific Ocean. And it's amazing. It's 14,000 feet tall. If you look at it, it's hard to imagine that because of the gentle slopes. So that combination of factors, plus the dark skies, the clarity of the skies, et cetera, makes Mauna Kea, without question, the best in the northern hemisphere, arguably the best in the world. So whether TMT goes at one spot on Mauna Kea or another is almost a detail compared to the fact that if it goes on Mauna Kea, its science future is vastly superior to any other place that you could locate it.
Let me just close by asking, final thoughts from each of you?
For me, it's disturbing to see the amount of damage being done at the social level with our community. Like I said, my wife's born and raised in Hawaii. We've raised our three kids there. And it's kind of unpredictable in how it affects people, but it's a little scary because of the amount of tension in the atmosphere right now, being driven by the whole protest movement. That said, I feel as confident as I do now as I did before the protest about a future for the Mauna Kea observatories. We came into this being number one worldwide. We have the best site in the world. We have $1 billion of equipment. We have 50 years of history. We have 500 plus people right now in the community, and hundreds before them that have worked at the observatory. So it's difficult to kind of extract the DNA of the Mauna Kea observatories out of Mauna Kea and Hawaii Island community. And that's why I feel confident that however the TMT conflict works out, because of this deep, in essence, personal connection we have, that will be the essence of what drives the future for Hawaii astronomy. It's the people.
Jessica?
I have a very deep belief in the amazing young people that we get to meet through the programs that we're working with, the local and Hawaiian students, and the ones who are working at our observatories. Making more programs for those young people to become the leaders that actually make those decisions. They're the ones whose vision I want to champion. And their passion and their certainty that they're going to find a way forward that is going to work for everyone is actually what gives me the hope that that's the foundation upon which the solutions for this and many of these other issues are going to be found.
I just want to speak about the perspective of the people who work at the observatories. They really love what they do. They love the science. They love the amazing equipment that lets us make these discoveries. And they love working with each other, working with the community. They're good people. They're part of the community. They enjoy what they do, and they really care about their neighbors and being in Hawaii. And so I just look forward to the time when this issue is less polarized and they can feel really good about what they do and not feel so much in conflict, feeling the conflict in the community about this, and be proud of what they do.
We've been talking with Dr. Doug Simons, Executive Director of the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, Dr. Jessica Dempsey, the Deputy Director of the East Asian Observatory and the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, and Rich Matsuda, the Chief of Operations at the W.M. Keck Observatory. Mahalo to each of you for coming in today.
Thank you.
As I mentioned before that interview at HPR, we are committed to hearing voices on all sides of this issue. We'd like to hear from you. You can call and leave a comment at 808-792-8217 or send an email to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Next week, we'll be taking a closer look at some of the cultural aspects of the Mauna Kea dispute and taking your calls in a live call-in program. Among our guests will be Dr. John Osorio, Dean of the University of Hawaii's Inuiakea School of Hawaiian Knowledge and an outspoken critic of the TMT Project.
Vladimir Putin has held power in Russia for 20 years, and each U.S. president has tried to work with him.
We had a very good dialogue.
That's why I committed to resetting the relationship between our two nations.
Well, I hope that we do have good relations with Russia.
But Russia's president has become less and less interested in working with the U.S. Putin and our presidents on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. When a number of successful musicians come together to form a band, the result is sometimes called a supergroup. Hawaii has had its share of supergroups, and for today's backyard quiz, we're putting a spotlight on one of them. It's a trio: drummer and percussionist Noel Ikimoto, bass player Dean Taba, and taiko drum master Kenny Endo. Their music has been described as a meeting of traditional Japanese taiko and Western improvisational drums, with the addition of vibraphone, marimba, Japanese flute, and six-string electric bass. Others have described the group as having a true world music sound, with elements of Afro-Cuban, New Orleans, Brazilian, swing, odd meter, blues, and Japanese, all fused with the improvisational spirit of jazz. For today's quiz, we want you to tell us the name of this Hawaii-based band. Here's a small hint. The group released a self-titled album in 2010, which included the track Gumbo Luau. If you think you know the answer, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm John Gatanda, president of Hawaii Pacific University, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's been 8 weeks since a jury convicted Catherine Kealoha on a series of federal felonies. It all started with an attempt to frame her uncle for stealing her mailbox. But that uncle, Gerard Puana, and his mother, Florence, still appear to face a steep price in a civil case, owing hundreds of thousands of dollars to Catherine Kealoha. Civil Beat reporter Nick Gruby has been following this story. And Nick, as you join us on the line, you captured the sense of this really for a lot of folks in your headline, a quote from Puana's attorney, a real injustice.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, thanks for having me on. And when the Puanas talk about what's going on with this civil case, the feelings are still really raw for them because despite the fact that the federal government seems to have proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Catherine Kealoha had bilked them out of money and then tried to frame Gerard Puana and have her grandmother declared legally incompetent during their criminal trial. They still somehow lost this civil case a few years before. Now, the federal government, of course, says that that was the result of a lot of false testimony and witness tampering and other issues that came up during that trial, but the fact of the matter, it still remains that they lost, the Puanas lost, and they still owe hundreds of thousands of dollars to Catherine Kealoha.
And so at this point, again, I know, Nick, you've followed every twist and turn of these proceedings long before it got to the trial stage. But for folks who have not been following every twist and turn, there's sort of an element of disbelief of how can that be? And then that's followed by the idea of what is it that they can do or that they're trying to do now to change that situation?
Well, getting to the first part of that question, how could this have happened? I think we have to go back to when this civil trial occurred, and that was in early 2015. At that point, there wasn't a lot of information that had been out there about the alleged frame job of Gerard Puano. Only a couple of news outlets had reported it this time. It came on the heels of a mistrial in the criminal case against Gerard Puana, and I think it was just a completely separate jury who was hearing these facts. And what also occurred in the case was the plaintiffs, in this case, the Puanas and their attorney, Gerald Kirishima, hadn't received all the information that the federal government was able to uncover over the course of years of investigation, such as the fact that the Kaloas had 30-plus bank accounts that the federal government says they were using to transfer money, some of it stolen back and forth between in order to get more loans and commit bank fraud. All of this information had yet to come out at this time. And again, they said that false information was provided by Catherine Kaloha while she was on the witness stand during the case. So when you say, how could this happen? I think that's what the government would argue is how that did happen. And in terms of next steps, you have the Puanas have appealed the verdict in the case, but the appeal that is before the appellate court does not include anything from this criminal trial that we just saw wrap up. So the judges are going to have to make their decisions based off of what's in the record already. Now, Gerald Kirishima, he's also looking at filing a motion to have a new trial in state court, but he still hasn't yet figured out how he's going to do that or when he's going to do that. It's something he's still exploring, because if the appellate judges do come down and uphold the ruling and that motion is denied, the Puanas are still on the hook for all this money.
Nick Ruby, it is a complicated story. It's an ongoing story. We'll be watching for developments. Nick Ruby will be following developments. You can follow him with his story on this case at civilbeat.org. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Bill. I appreciate it.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites you to a screening of Moana Nui a Kea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members. Sunday, August 18th in Waimea on Hawaii Island, Sunday, August 25th in Honolulu, and Saturday, August 31st in Lihue. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Dawson.
When people talk about the American dream, part of that is often the idea that you're likely to be better off than your parents were. Now, that assumption has been getting a closer look with a lot of attention from economists doing some remarkable research. Our contributing editor, Neil Milner, is here with some further insights about Raj Chetty.
Yes, Raj Chetty. And we've talked about some of his work on the show before. Hmm. But there's a very good profile of him in the recent Atlantic. And it's worth looking at it about his personal life and his professional life and about explaining this. Chetty, in a nutshell, has done some extraordinarily important things for understanding the United States, one of which is that he did it on the basis of using data that's been around for a long time, but no one's figured out how to use it in this sophisticated way. But he looked at, does the American dream exist? Is there still a great deal of social mobility? The answer is no, that – you, in 1940, a person born in 1940 had a 50% chance of being better off than his parents.
90%.
I'm sorry. That's right. In the person born in 1990, it's significantly less, much less of a chance. He's also, in other research, has shown that we're not a very, compared to other countries, not very social mobile. So that's the first thing that he did. The other thing that he did is to show that this varies by neighborhood and by census tract. That what's interesting is that if you look at the general, if you just look at how this is generally, that's true. But for reasons that he as yet doesn't understand, there are that this varies very much for neighborhoods, that is, and for cities. That in Salt Lake, you're much more likely to become socially mobile, let's say, than in Milwaukee. So this is where he's put us right now. This is the best research we have on an essential question in American society, which is, are we really that socially mobile? We know the answer is no. We know, though, that some places within the little pieces of the puzzles are do much better in terms of opportunity than others. So those are the two things. And what he's done with the help of huge research grants from Bill Gates and from one of the Zuckerberg foundations is to create an institute that says, we have this knowledge now. We know that some places, some neighborhoods do better than others. We know certain things about it. How can we intervene in cities to make this thing work? And they have projects in eight cities. So that's in a nutshell of where it is. You just find out an enormous amount of information about the way societies work, the way American society works in little bit of pieces. And that, to me, is the most important, and I think to him the most important factor, because it's about what he calls microscopic research.
You know, it was interesting also just in terms of his approach on this. I love that the group that he works with at Harvard that he put together is called Opportunity Insights.
Because
it's all about opportunity and the enhancing, the putting someone in a position to succeed, really.
That's right. And that's the real interesting potential, because it's about making interventions on the basis of information that we've never really had before that will make those kinds of difference. We have the insights. We know what opportunity means. And we know that we know a little bit about why certain places give more opportunities than others. For example, moving from a low opportunity neighborhood to a high opportunity neighborhood affects the children who made this move for years to come. That's an important kind of factor. We also know how much race enters into it. What he's trying to find out now is, why are there differences in neighborhoods? For example, and this is part of what he's trying to do in order to make the interventions better. There are neighborhoods in which, if you look at them, they have all kinds of similarities. They're similarly poor, they're similarly rich, whatever else. But one of those neighborhoods will be much more likely to create opportunities down the road for people, that they give them the potential, than others. And it's not clear why. We can talk, there are some ideas in a second. But that's really what they're trying to do. So he's trying to figure out with his staff, how do you use these opportunity insights to intervene in policy?
You know, and that sort of interaction between the academic pursuit and the real world application in terms of policy is really an interesting one.
Yeah.
It's characterized of the staff at Opportunity Insights has learned, when an economist gets lost, a sociologist can touch his elbow and say, you know, I've been noticing some things.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we can talk about that for a second. Most of the economists who win the Nobel Prize do really important research, much of which people can't understand unless you're an expert, because at the level of theory, and I'm not at all denigrating that, but it's a different kind of thing to understand how markets work, all of this. This is very focused on things that people can understand. And what Chetty says it's like. He says, think about medical research. Okay, medical research is kind of microscopic. You look for things that cause problems, and then you intervene to deal with it. And that's an interesting way, I think, to think about both the challenges and the advantages of doing it this way. The advantages are it's very focused, it's very policy-oriented. We know what we don't know.
Right.
Right, and so you can kind of work with that. And if you read the Atlantic profile, you get a pretty good understanding. You won't understand the nuts and bolts of how he put that data together. I don't know how he used it. That's big data at its best. But here's the challenge of microscopic research. If you think about cancer research, the way we now think about cancer, one of the biggest accomplishments in cancer research is that we've discovered that it's not a cancer, it's a multiplicity of cancers. Mm-hmm. And what that's meant is that you have to deal with all these different multiplicities in very different ways. Small interventions, personalized treatment, genetic testing to see exactly what you have. If you apply that to social mobility research, you can think about the fact that, okay, at one level, you know that there's low levels of social mobility in this country. But at the same, and that's easy to show, and he's got some great maps about how you show it. But the challenge is, if you're doing microscopic research, if you know things vary by neighborhood and you're trying to intervene, everything becomes more micro. Everything becomes more detailed. You have to look at things that actually work in that particular neighborhood and in another particular neighborhood.
You know, another fascinating aspect of this research is that, as you say, with big data and with census, we've spoken before
and
about
tax how, and tax stuff
and, yeah. and tax records. But as a journalist, I have learned to love the census for decades, and there is so much information. But pulling out the information and interpreting and analyzing it is another matter entirely. And he does a very impressive job of being able to do that again in a way that is meaningful for people's lives in influencing policy.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think that journalists don't really have the time or the skills to be able to put this kind of stuff together. No one could. Mm. I mean, it's just very few. But if you have data-friendly or person-friendly stuff, or you have a journalist working on the team, it can make a lot of difference. Here's the one thing that even Chetty admits is a problem. One of the reasons that we are where we are with social mobility is a macro reason, and that's called racism. That's the legacy of slavery, the kind of stubborn inequality, and to be very specific, the federal government's role in creating racial segregation, in creating housing segregation, and how, and we can show this empirically, that lingers into all kinds of social pathologies now. So Chetty's working inside of that. Hmm. He's making changes and interventions inside of that. But how that will buck up against arguably 150 years of federal housing policies that created the very kinds of neighborhoods that are the troublesome ones, or how it deals with the legacy of racism, that's going to be a real challenge.
Described in that map was the analogy of the map of opportunity of the United States along with what the map looked like pre-Civil
yes.
War.
Yes, it looks the same. And it's not the only one that did that. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did a research project about 2 months ago where it took the redlining map that the federal government used in the 30s to say, you know, you can't get good housing, you can't get loans there because it would mix the neighborhood. It superimposed a map of Milwaukee now in terms of where the high crime rates were, where the, you know, all kinds of other difficulties were.
Same
terrific
matters.
Overlap. Absolutely.
Neil Milner, fascinating. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Neil, retired professor of political science, of course, and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. Thank you.
In the late 90s, a group of musicians got together to try to answer a question.
What could happen when strangers meet?
The unexpected creativity that can come from working or playing or falling in love with someone very different from yourself. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
Earlier in the program, we asked you about a music supergroup where several highly skilled musicians come together from various other groups to collaborate. Hawaii's been home to several musical supergroups over the years, and for today's backyard quiz, we put a spotlight on one of them. It's a trio: drummer and percussionist Noel Okimoto, bass player Dean Taba, taiko drum master Kenny Endo. Their music, often described as a blend of traditional Japanese taiko and Western improvisational jazz drumming, with the addition of vibraphone, marimba, Japanese flute, six-string electric bass. The group also said to create a true world music sound, influenced by musical styles including Afro-Cuban, New Orleans, Brazilian, swing, odd meter, blues, Japanese. For today's quiz, we asked for the name of this Hawaii-based supergroup. We even gave you a hint. The group released a self-titled album in 2010, including the track Gumbo Luau. If you can name other tracks on that album, you already know the group is Rhythm Summit. But none of you did know that, or at least you didn't share your knowledge with us. So that's one for the books. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. When it comes to climate change, much of the focus in Hawaii tends, naturally enough, to start with the ocean. And there is a lot there: rising sea levels, warming temperatures, impact on everything from coral bleaching to beach erosion. But a report out last week from the United Nations highlighted the importance of the way people use the land. HPR's Noe Tanigawa took a closer look at that, along with some expert help, and is here with a little perspective.
You're so right on that, Bill. This report from the International Panel on Climate Change, it's the UN Commission, tells us how land stores carbon and releases carbon, both. The world scientists are saying that if we keep degrading the land as we're doing now, we're going to start, the land itself is going to start releasing more carbon than it takes in.
Basically, the report is a call to action to humanity to start to implement some important steps that have not really gotten a lot of headlines recently. For instance, if we treated the dirt differently, if we treated the chemistry of our soil differently, we could actually increase our food production, and we could decrease the soil pollution that comes from erosion. We could decrease the nitrogen pollution that goes into our waterways, and we could increase the ability of soil to pull carbon out of the atmosphere and assist us with our efforts to stop global warming.
Are you talking about changing big agriculture?
Yes, exactly. Talking about changing big agriculture.
I think that's proven to be pretty difficult.
Big agriculture is starting to do this on its own.
Why?
Because it saves money. You don't have to buy as much industrial fertilizer if you simply plant these cover crops, these secondary crops, at the same time that you plant your primary crop. It saves soil by preventing soil erosion, and so crop lands are not used up as rapidly. And they are seeing that working with the land and working with efforts to stop climate change are in their bottom line interest as well.
Are we doing anything like that here?
In Hawaii, we have an amazing blossoming community of organic farmers that are treating the land this way because, number one, it's consistent with indigenous views of the land, that the land is living and that you must treat it with respect. Number two, it's consistent with a more healthy environment and community in Hawaii. It's consistent with stopping the pollution of our coastal waters and
how about food sustainability?
Damaging our reefs. And if we can find incentives to promote more sustainable agriculture, it's called regenerative farming practices. If we can find principally economic incentives, and that would call on the state legislature, then I think it would increase our food sustainability.
Oh, you're calling for regenerative agriculture. Is this something
Correct.
New?
It's not new.
It sounds kind of very old.
Well, yes, it's indigenous, actually. It's how original food was grown by people living extremely close to the land and knowing what the land needs.
Oh, so, but Chip, I mean, fringe people have been calling for us to go organic and all this for,
right.
I mean, for a long time.
Well, the problem is they've always been considered fringe.
Yeah.
So it's becoming more mainstream.
Really?
There was a lot of hope in that comment. And I can tell you that, yes. But it's not fast enough. And so, as I've said many times, it actually will take courage to change, right?
And what would we do locally?
Locally, we would provide financial subsidies for local food production, maybe exempt all locally grown food from the general excise tax. Maybe we could produce a series of grants or favorable loans, low-interest loans, for expanding food production here in Hawaii. If we passed laws making regenerative farming the way that you have to farm the land, everybody would have to do it. And that's essentially what's needed globally. It actually will take courage to change. I've recently become a vegan, so it took courage for me to walk away from meat. It took courage to change my diet. It will take courage for the state legislature and for the United Nations to really push hard on this need.
You're back with that unwelcome advice.
You like your steak, huh? Is that what you're saying?
No, I haven't eaten meat since 1976.
Oh, well, why is it unwelcome advice?
That's what Bill always gives me. He's like, he's a pretty open-minded guy. Were you ever like that? Were you ever like stuff,
yes.
eating meat?
Yes.
No
I
was, way.
I was like, climate change is not caused by humans. It's part of a natural cycle. I was totally there.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. But then I started getting informed. I read. I determined what was fact and what was fantasy. I confirmed what I was reading, and I changed my opinions, and I changed my lifestyle. It's about keeping an open mind and wanting to be a contributing citizen of the planet.
Oh, man, this climate change means we have to change.
Yes, it does. Climate change means we have to change.
Sorry to throw you under the bus there, Bill, for a second, but you know something? This conversation with Chip Fletcher, I'm sorry I didn't introduce him officially, Chip Fletcher, a great resource for us here for Planet 808. He's a climate change expert here in our town, author of the text, Climate Change, What the Science Tells Us. And he's telling us now that it's time to go vegan and vegetarian.
You know, it makes me leap into the fray as a, not to be in defense of bacon, but realistically, not everybody's going to give up meat. But even, and this is part of the UN report as well, reduction in meat consumption is something that leads to, again, better use of land.
Well, you know, that's so interesting because something like 3.2% of Americans are vegetarians now. Mm. Can you believe that's such a tiny, but you wouldn't, I mean, for the talk about it, it seems like a lot, it would be a larger percentage.
Much higher in India, for example.
Yeah. Well, here in America, millennials, 12% of them are self-identified as vegetarians. That's much larger than the average. Mm-hmm. And the generation after that supposedly is even bigger into being vegan. So this could be a move into the future and a move that, you know, definitely is going to benefit a lot of different sectors.
Interesting. One other sort of headline that popped out of that report, Earth land masses make up 30% of the globe, mostly ocean, but they are warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet.
Yeah, and we're thinking about those oceans and the food we can get from it. I mean, I don't eat meat, but I still love sushi, and it's hard for me to convince myself that a peeled pepper is as good on a piece of rice, okay, as aku. But I just heard that Lou Cooperhouse is coming into town, and he's the head of Blue Nalu now, which is starting to do cellular aquaculture. Think about that. So he'll be coming into town a little later on in the year. different ways to learn about ways to not eat meat. And we all know how, you know, there are these different burgers that have been coming on the scene and having such great splashy intros into the dietary scene.
There's still something at the end of the day to be said for moderation as well.
Yeah, right. You sound like my husband.
That's all right. Noe Tanigawa, you know her. She covers arts and culture at HPR. You can find her climate change segments, Planet 808, Climate Change in the Islands, on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. You can go ahead over to the news and talk section of the HawaiiPublicRadio.org website.